The horse wasn't pleased with the slow pace and kept twitching under him, wanting to break into a gallop. But William held him to a steady trot, nodding as he passed each company, looking to the corporals and sergeants to see if any were in difficulty or needed assistance.
"Water's coming," he called to a particularly wilted-looking group of loyalist refugees who had stopped on the verge of the road, taking pause in the scant shade provided by a scatter of oak saplings and a handcart precariously piled with their belongings. This reassurance made the women look up hopefully from under their bonnets, and the gentleman rose to his feet, waving William down. He reined in and recognized Mr. Endicott, a well-to-do Philadelphia merchant, and his family. He'd been to dinner at their house and had danced with the two older Mrs. Endicott at several parties.
"Your servant, sir," he said, sweeping off his hat with a bow and nodding in turn to the ladies. "And yours, Mrs. Endicott, Miss Endicott, Miss Sally, and your most humble and obedient, Miss Peggy."
Miss Peggy Endicott, aged 9, went pink as a young strawberry at being singled out, and her elder sisters exchanged raised brows over her head.
"Is it true, Lord Ellesmere," Endicott said, "that we are closely pursued by the rebels?"
He was holding a large red flannel handkerchief with which he wiped a perspiring round face.
The ladies find themselves somewhat worried by the prospect."
"The ladies have no cause for concern, sir," William assured him. "You are under the protection of His Majesty's army, you know."
"Well, yes, we do know that," Mr. Endicott said rather testily. "Or so we hope, at least. Certainly wouldn't be here else, I can tell you. But have you any news of Washington's whereabouts is what I'd like to know."
Visigoth shifted his weight and danced a little, eager to be off. But William pulled his head round, clicking his tongue in rebuke.
"Why, yes, sir," he said respectfully. "We've had several deserters from the rebel camp come in last night. They say that Washington is gathering his troops, no doubt in hopes of catching up to us, but he has no more than 2,000 regulars with a few scrubby militia companies."
Mr. Endicott looked somewhat reassured at this, but the girls and their mother didn't. Mrs. Endicott plucked at her husband's sleeve and murmured something. He flushed more deeply.
"I said I'll deal with it, madam," he snapped.
He had taken off his wig because of the heat, and wore a spotted silk handkerchief tied over his head against the sun. His grizzled hair was cropped short, and tiny bristles stuck out from the edges of the kerchief like the feelers of angry insects. Mrs. Endicott's lips pressed tight, but she stepped back, jerking her head in a small nod. Miss Peggy, though, emboldened by Captain Ellesmere's particularity, scampered forward and seized hold of his stirrup. Visigoth, startled by the flying scrap of calico at the corner of his vision, shied violently. Peggy shrieked, stumbled back, and went flying. All of the Endicott ladies were shrieking, but William could do nothing about that. He fought the horse's head round and held on grimly while Goth crow-hopped and whirled, then settled down gradually, snorting and jerking at the bit. He could hear passing infantrymen being profanely amused as their column swerved to go round him.
"Is Miss Peggy quite all right?" he inquired, breathing heavily as he finally brought the horse back to the verge.
Miss Anne Endicott was standing near the edge of the road waiting for him. The rest of her family had retreated, and he heard a loud howling coming from behind the handcart.
"Aside from being spanked by Papa for nearly being killed, yes," Miss Endicott replied, looking amused. She drew a little closer, keeping a wary eye on Goth. But the horse was calm enough now, stretching his neck to grab a mouthful of grass.
"I'm sorry to be the cause of her distress," William said politely, and groped in his pocket, coming out with nothing but a crumpled handkerchief and a stray sixpence.
He handed the coin down to Anne, smiling.
"Give her that, will you, with my apologies."
"She will be fine," Anne said, but took the coin.
She glanced over her shoulder, then drew a step closer and spoke rapidly, lowering her voice.
I hesitate to ask, Lord Ellesmere, but you see, the cart has broken a wheel. My father cannot fix it. He won't abandon our belongings, and my mother is terrified that we will be overtaken and captured by Washington's men."
Her dark eyes, very fine dark eyes, fixed on his with a brilliant intensity.
Can you help? Please? That was what my little sister meant to ask you.
Oh. What exactly is the trouble with... Never mind. Let me have a look.
It would do Gough no harm to settle for a few minutes. He swung down and tied the horse to one of the saplings, then followed Miss Endicott to the handcart. It was overflowing with the same higgledy-piggledy assortment of goods he'd seen on the docks 2 days ago. A tall clock stuck out of heaped clothing and linens, and a homely earthenware chamber pot was stuffed with handkerchiefs, stockings, and what was probably Mrs. Endicott's jewel case. The sight of this particular mess gave him a sudden pang, though. These were the remnants of a real home, one he'd been a guest in, the rubbish and treasures of people he knew and liked. He'd heard that very clock with its pierced work crown strike midnight just before he'd stolen a kiss from Anne Endicott in the shadows of her father's hallway. He felt the mellow bong, bong, now deep in his vitals.
"Where will you go?" he asked quietly, a hand on her arm.
She turned to him, flushed and harried, her dark hair coming out of her cap, but still with dignity. "I don't know," she said, just as quietly. "My Aunt Platt lives in a small village near New York, but I don't know that we can travel so far as we are." She nodded at the unwieldy cart, surrounded by bags and half-wrapped bundles. "Perhaps we can find a safe place closer and wait there while my father goes to make... arrangements." Her lips pressed suddenly tight, and he realized that she was holding on to her composure by dint of great effort, and that it was unshed tears that made her eyes so bright. He took her hand and kissed it gently.
"I'll help," he said. Easier said than done. While the axle of the cart was intact, one wheel had struck a jagged rock and not merely popped off, but had in the process lost the flat iron tire that encircled the fellows, which, in consequence, had come apart, being badly glued. The wheel lay in pieces in the grass, and a gaudy orange and black butterfly perched on the disjunct hub, lazily fanning its wings. Mrs. Endicott's fears weren't unfounded. Neither was Mr. Endicott's anxiety, which he was attempting with little success to disguise as irritability. If they were stranded for too long, and left behind, even if Washington's regular troops were moving too fast for looting, there were always scavengers on the outskirts of an army. Any army. A respectful period of inspection allowed Mr. Endicott, still red-faced but more settled, to emerge from his domestic imbroglio, followed by Peggy, also red-faced and downcast. William nodded to the merchant and gestured, summoning him to join in contemplation of the wreckage out of hearing of the women. "Are you armed, sir?" William asked quietly.
Endicott's face paled noticeably, and his Adam's apple bobbed above his dirt-grimed stock.
"I have a fowling piece that belonged to my father," he said,
in a voice so low as to be scarcely audible.
It's not been fired in 20 years. "God," William thought, appalled.
William felt himself naked and edgy without weapons. Endicott had to be 50 at least, and alone here with 4 women to protect.
"I'll find you help, sir," William said firmly.
Mr. Endicott drew a deep, deep breath. William thought the man might sob if obliged to speak, and turned without haste toward the women, talking as he went.
"There will be a Cooper or Wainwright somewhere along the column. Ah, and here's the water carrier coming."
He extended a hand to Peggy.
"Will you come with me to catch him, Miss Margaret? I'm sure he'll stop for a pretty face."
She didn't smile, but she sniffed and wiped her nose on her sleeve, drew herself up, and took his hand. The Endicott ladies were nothing if not courageous. A bored-looking mule pulled a cart with several barrels of water, passing slowly down the column, the driver pausing when hailed. William waded determinedly into the fray, lifting Peggy in his arms for safety, to her evident delight, and deflected the carrier to the Endicott's service. Then, with a sweep of his hat to the ladies, he mounted again and made his way down the road in search of a cooper. The army travelled with the equivalent of several villages' worth of artisans, and those men called supportives, coopers, carpenters, cooks, smiths, farriers, wainwrights, drovers, hauliers, orderlies, to say nothing of the vast swarm of laundresses and seamstresses among the camp followers. It wouldn't take long to find a cooper or a wainwright and persuade him to deal with the Endicott's trouble. William glanced at the sun. Nearly three. The army was proceeding briskly, but that didn't mean it was moving at any great rate of speed. Clinton had given orders to march an additional 2 hours per day, though, a strain in the increasing heat. Another 2 hours before they made camp. With luck, the Endicotts might be whole again by then and able to keep up tomorrow. A rumble of hoofs and catcalls from the infantry caught his attention and made him glance over his shoulder, heart speeding up. Dragoons, plumes fluttering. He reined up and rode Gough straight at them, glancing from face to face as he passed down their double line. Several of them stared at him, and an officer made irritated motions at him, but he ignored that. A small voice at the back of his mind inquired what he meant to do if he found Harkness among them, but he ignored that, too. He passed the end of the company, circled to the rear, and rode up the other side of the column, looking back over his shoulder at the rank of puzzled faces staring at him, some affronted, some amused. No, no, no. Maybe? Would he even recognize the fellow, he wondered. He'd been very drunk. Still, he thought, Harkness would recognize him. They were all staring at him by this time, but none with an aspect either of alarm or violence. Their colonel reined up a little and called to him.
Ho, Ellesmere! Lost something, have you?
He squinted against the sun and made out the vivid face of Ban Tarleton, red-cheeked and grinning under his flamboyant plumed helmet. He jerked his chin up in invitation, and William wheeled his horse and fell in beside him.
Not lost exactly, he said. Just looking for a dragoon I met in Philadelphia. Named Harkness. You know him?
Ban pulled a face.
Yes, he's with the 26th. Randy bugger, always after women.
And you aren't?
Ban wasn't a close friend, but William had been out on the Randan with him once or twice in London. He didn't drink much, but he didn't need to. He was the sort of man who always seemed a little intoxicated. Tarleton laughed, face flushed with the heat and red-lipped as a girl.
Yes. But Harkness doesn't care about anything but women. Known him to have three at once in a brothel.
William considered that one for a moment.
All right, I can see a use for two, maybe. But what's the third one for?
Ban, who was maybe 4 years older than William, gave him the sort of pitying look reserved for virgins and confirmed bachelors, then ducked back, laughing when William punched him in the arm.
Right. William said. That aside, I'm looking for a wainwright or a cooper. Any close by?
Tarleton straightened his helmet and shook his head.
No, but there's bound to be one or two in that mess.
He gestured negligently at the train of baggage wagons.
Which regiment are you with these days?
He frowned at William, seeming to realize that something was amiss with his dress.
Where's your sword? And your gorget?
William gritted his teeth. They really did grit, there being so much coarse dust in the air, and apprised Tarleton of his situation in the minimum number of words. He didn't mention where or under what circumstances he had lost his gorget, and, with a brief salute of farewell to the colonel, reined round and went down the column again. He was breathing as though he'd run the length of London Bridge, and pulses of electricity were running down his arms and legs, jolting at the base of his spine. His anger over his situation had been rekindled by his conversation with Tarleton, and, unable to do any bloody thing about any of it, turned his mind to what he wanted to do to Harkness should he meet the 26th Light Dragoons. He touched his chest by reflex, and his sudden urge to do violence changed at once to an equally sudden rush of desire that made him light-headed.
Then he recalled his original errand, and hot blood washed through his face. He rode more slowly, calming his mind. Harkness could wait. The Endicotts couldn't. Thought of the family pained him, and not only because he was ashamed of letting himself be distracted from their difficulty, but in recollecting them now, he realized that for those few moments with the Endicotts, concerned with their troubles, he'd forgotten. Forgotten the burden he'd been carrying like a pound of lead in his chest. Forgotten who he really was. What would Anne Endicott have done if she knew? Her parents, even... Well, no. He smiled, despite his disquiet. He didn't think Peggy Endicott would mind if he told her he was secretly a cut-purse or a cannibal, let alone a... Everyone else she knew, though. The Endicotts were only one loyalist family who'd welcomed him into their home, and he'd not taken proper leave of any of those who chose to stay in Philadelphia. Too ashamed to see them, knowing the truth. He looked back over his shoulder. The Endicotts were barely visible, now sitting in the grass in a companionable circle, sharing food of some kind. He felt a keen pang at the sight of their companionability. He'd never be part of a decent family. Couldn't ever marry a woman, even of such modest origins as Anne Endicott. Her father might well be ruined, might have lost his wealth and business. The family might descend into poverty. But they would remain who they were, firm in their courage and the pride of their name. Not him. His name didn't belong to him. Well, he could marry, he grudgingly admitted to himself, making his way gingerly through a group of camp followers. But only a woman who wanted nothing but his title and money would have him. And to wed under such circumstances, knowing that your wife despised you. And to know that you passed the taint of your blood to your sons. This morbid train of thought stopped abruptly with the appearance of a small group of artisans, trudging beside a large wagon that undoubtedly held their tools. He came down on them like a wolf on a flock of startled sheep, and ruthlessly cut out a fine, fat Wainwright, whom he persuaded by threats and bribery to mount behind him, and thus carried his prey back to the Endicotts. With his spirit soothed by their gratitude, he turned northward again toward the head of the army, camp, and his supper. Absorbed in thoughts of roast chicken and gravy, he ate with Clinton's staff, and thus ate very well. He didn't notice at once that another horseman had caught up alongside him, matching his pace. "Penny for your thoughts," said a pleasant, half-familiar voice, and he turned to find himself looking into the smiling face of Dennis Randall Isaacs. William regarded Randall Isaacs with something between annoyance and curiosity. The man had, to all effects, abandoned him in Quebec City a year and a half before, and vanished, leaving him to spend the winter snowbound with nuns and voyageurs. The experience had improved both his French and his hunting abilities, but not his temper. "Captain Randall Isaacs," he said in acknowledgement rather coldly. The captain smiled sunnily at him, not at all put off by his tone. "Oh, just Randall these days," he said. "My father's name, you know. The other bit was a courtesy to my stepfather. But as the old man's passed on now..." He lifted one shoulder, leaving William to draw the obvious conclusion that a Jewish-sounding surname couldn't be an asset to an ambitious officer. "Surprised to see you here," Randall went on, chummy, as though they'd seen each other at a ball last month. "You were at Saratoga with Burgoyne, weren't you?"
William's hand tightened on the reins, but he patiently explained his peculiar status. "For possibly the 20th time."
Randall nodded, respectful.
"Certainly better than cutting hay in Massachusetts," he said with a glance at the marching columns they were passing. "Thought of going back to England, though?"
"No," William said, somewhat startled. "Why?"
"For one thing, I doubt I can, by the terms of parole. For another, why should I?"
"Why indeed," he thought with a fresh stab. He'd not even begun to think about what awaited him in England, at Hellwater, at Ellesmere.
In London, for that matter.
Oh, Jesus.
Why, indeed,
Randall said, unconsciously echoing him. The man sounded thoughtful.
Well, not much opportunity for distinguishing yourself here, is there?
He glanced very briefly at William's belt, bare of weapons, and away again directly, as though the sight was somehow shameful, which it was.
And what is it you think I could do there?
William demanded, keeping his temper with some difficulty.
Well, you are an earl,
Randall pointed out. William felt the blood rise up his neck, but couldn't say anything.
You have a seat in the House of Lords. Why not use it to accomplish something? Take up politics. Doubt your parole says anything about that, and as long as you weren't going back to rejoin the army, I shouldn't think the travel itself would be a problem.
I never thought of it,
William said, striving for politeness. He couldn't think of anything he'd less rather do than be political, unless it was be political while acting a sham. Randall tilted his head amiably to and fro, still smiling. He was much as he had been when William had seen him last. Dark hair, tied back without powder, good-looking rather than handsome, slender, without being slight, graceful in movement, with a constant expression of sympathetic geniality. He hadn't changed much, but William had. He was 2 years older now, much more experienced, and was both surprised and a little gratified to discover that he realized that Randall was playing him like a hand of bezique.
Or trying to. I suppose there are other possibilities, he said, guiding his horse around an enormous puddle of muddy urine that had collected in a dip in the road.
Randall's horse had paused to add to it. Randall sat as composedly as one can in such a situation, but didn't try to raise his voice over the noise. He picked his way out of the mud and caught William up before continuing the conversation.
Possibilities?
He sounded genuinely interested and probably was, William thought. But why?
What were you thinking of doing?
You recall Captain Richardson, of course? William asked casually, but with an eye on Randall's face. One dark brow rose a bit, but otherwise he showed no particular emotion at hearing the name.
"Oh, yes," Randall replied, as casual as William. "Have you seen the good captain recently?"
"Yes,
a couple of days ago."
William's temper had abated, and he waited with interest to see what Randall might have to say to this. The captain didn't look taken aback, exactly, but his air of pleasant inconsequence had definitely sharpened into something else. William could actually see him wondering whether to ask bluntly what Richardson had wanted or to take another tack, and the perception gave him a small thrill.
"Is Lord John with Sir Henry?"
Randall asked.
That was enough of a non-sequitur to make William blink, but there was no reason not to answer.
"No. Why should he be?"
The brow lifted again.
"You didn't know. The Duke of Bardolph's regiment is in New York."
"It is."
William was more than startled by that, but hastened to collect himself.
"How do you know?"
Randall waved a well-manicured hand, as though the answer to this was irrelevant, as perhaps it was.
"Bardolph left Philadelphia this morning with Sir Henry," he explained. "As the Duke has recalled Lord John to duty, I thought..."
"He what?"
William's horse jerked his head and snorted at the exclamation, and William stroked the big neck, using the gesture to avert his face for a moment.
His father was here?
"I stopped at his lordship's house in Philadelphia yesterday," Randall explained, "and a rather odd Scotchwoman, she must be his lordship's housekeeper, I collect, told me that his lordship had been gone for several days. But if you haven't seen him..."
Randall raised his head, looking ahead. A haze of wood smoke was already showing above the trees, cook fires, wash fires, and watch fires all marking the growing camp, their tang a pleasant spice in the nostrils. It made William's stomach growl.
"Hup, hup, hut the double, quick march!"
A sergeant's bellow came from behind them, and they pulled aside for a double column of infantry who hadn't needed the exhortation.
They were eager for their dinner and the chance to lay down their arms for the night.
The pause gave William room for a moment's thought. Ought he to ask Randall to sup with him later?
Try to draw him out? Or get the hell away from the man as quickly as possible, using his need to wait on Sir Henry as excuse?
But what if Lord John really was with Sir Henry right at this moment?
And bloody Uncle Hal. All he needed in the present circumstance. Randall had evidently used the pause for thought as well, and come to his own decision. He came up close beside William, and after a quick glance to be sure no one was near them, leaned close and spoke in a low voice.
I say this as a friend, Ellesmere. Though I grant you've no reason to trust me, I hope you'll listen. Don't, for God's sake, engage in any enterprise that Richardson suggests. Don't go with him anywhere, no matter what the circumstances. If you can avoid it, don't even talk to him again.
And with that, he reined his horse's head around, spurred up abruptly, and was off down the road at a gallop, heading away from the camp. Chapter 51 Scrounging. Grey wouldn't mind, if it weren't for the headaches. The ache in his side had faded to something tolerable. He thought a rib might be cracked, but as long as he didn't have to run, that wouldn't be a problem. The eye, though. The injured eye stubbornly refused to move, but jerked in its socket, pulling against whatever obstruction held it. An orbicularis muscle? Was that what Dr. Hunter had called it, in an attempt to focus with its fellow? This was painful and exhausting in itself, but also led to double vision and to crushing headaches, and he found himself often unable to eat when they halted, wanting only to lie down in darkness and wait for the throbbing to cease. By the time they stopped to make camp on the evening of the second day of March, he could barely see out of his good eye, and his stomach was heaving with nausea.
Here,
he said, thrusting his hot johnny cake at one of his fellows, a tailor from Morristown named Phillipson.
You take it. I can't, not just...
He couldn't go on, but pressed the heel of his hand hard against his closed eye. Green and yellow pinwheels and brilliant flashes of light erupted behind his eyelid, but the pressure eased the pain for a moment.
You save it for later, Bert, Phillipson said, tucking the johnny cake into Grey's rucksack.
He bent close and peered at Grey's face in the firelight.
You need a patch for that eye, he declared. Keep you from rubbing at it, at least. It's red as a horse stocking. Here.
And with that, he took off his own battered felt hat, and whipping a small pair of scissors from his bosom, cut a neat round patch from the brim, rubbed a bit of spruce gum round the edge to make it stick, and then bound it carefully in place over the injured orb with a spotted handkerchief contributed by one of the other militiamen. All of them clustered round to watch with the kindest expressions of concern, offers of food and drink, suggestions as to which company had a surgeon that might come to let his blood, and so on. Grey, in the weakness of pain and exhaustion, thought he might weep. He managed to thank them all for their concern, but at last they left off, and after a swig of something unidentifiable, but strongly alcoholic, from Jacob's canteen, he sat on the ground, shut his good eye, leaned his head back against a log, and waited for the throbbing in his temples to lessen. Despite his bodily discomfort, he felt comforted in spirit. The men with him weren't soldiers, and God knew they weren't an army, but they were men, engaged in common purpose and mindful of one another, and that was a thing he knew and loved.
And we bring our needs and desires before thee, O great Lord, and implore thy blessing upon our deeds.
The Reverend Woodsworth was conducting a brief service of prayers. He did this every evening. Those who wished might join him. Those who didn't occupied themselves in quiet conversation or small tasks of mending or whittling. Grey had no real idea where they were, save somewhere to the northeast of Philadelphia. Messengers on horseback met them now and then, and confused bits of news and speculation spread like fleas through the group.
he gathered that the British army was heading north, clearly to New York, and that Washington had left Valley Forge with his troops and was intending to attack Clinton somewhere en route. But no one knew where. The troops were to muster at a place called Coryell's Ferry, at which point they might possibly be told where they were going. He didn't waste energy on thinking about his own position. He could escape easily enough in the darkness, but there was no point in doing so. Wandering around the countryside in the midst of converging militia companies and regular troops, he ran more risk of ending up back in the custody of Colonel Smith, who would probably hang him out of hand, than he did in remaining with Woodsworth's militia. The danger might increase when they did join Washington's troops, but large armies really couldn't hide from each other, nor did they try to avoid notice. If Washington got anywhere near Clinton, Gray could, at that point, easily desert, if one considered it desertion, and cross the lines into British hands, risking only being shot by an over-enthusiastic sentry before he could surrender and make himself known. Gratitude, he thought, hearing Mr. Woodsworth's prayer through a haze of growing drowsiness and fading pain. Well, yes, there were a few more things he could count on his list of blessings. William was still on parole, and thus a non-combatant. Jamie Fraser had been released from the Continental Army to escort Brigadier Fraser's body back to Scotland. Though he'd returned, he was no longer in the army. He wouldn't be in this fight either. His nephew Henry was healing, but in no way fit for combat. There was no one likely to be involved in the coming battle, if there was one, over whom he need worry. Though, come to think. His hand found the empty pocket of his breeches. Hal. Where the bloody hell was Hal? He sighed, but then relaxed, breathing in the sense of wood smoke, pine needles and roasted corn. Wherever Hal was, he'd be safe enough. His brother could take care of himself. The prayer's over, one of his companions had started to sing. It was a song he knew, but the words were quite different. His version, picked up from an army surgeon who'd fought with the colonials during the French and Indian War, went, "Brother Ephraim sold his cow and brought him a commission, and then he went to Canada to fight for the nation. But when Ephraim he came home, he proved an arrant coward. He wouldn't fight the Frenchman there for fear of being devoured." Dr. Shuckburgh hadn't had much opinion of the colonials, and neither had the composer of the newer version used as a marching song. He'd heard that one in Philadelphia and hummed along under his breath. "Yankee Doodle came to town for to buy a firelock. We will tar and feather him, and so we will John Hancock." His present companions were now singing with gusto the latest evolution. "Yankee Doodle went to town, a-riding on a pony, stuck a feather in his cap, and called it macaroni." He wondered, yawning, whether any of them knew that the word doodle meant simpleton in German. He doubted Morristown, New Jersey, had ever seen a macaroni, those affected young men who went in for pink wigs and a dozen face patches. As his headache eased, he began to appreciate the simple pleasure of reclining. The shoes that went with his disguise fit him badly, and as well as rubbing his heels raw, gave him shooting pains in the shins from the effort of constantly clenching his toes in order to keep the bloody things on. He stretched his legs gingerly, almost enjoying the tenderness in his muscles, so near bliss by contrast with walking. He was distracted from his catalogue of meagre blessings by a small hungry gulp near his ear, followed by a young, low voice. "Mister, if you're not mean to eat that Johnny cake yourself." "What? Oh, yes, of course." He struggled to sit up, one hand pressed protectively over his bad eye, and turned his head to see a boy of 11 or 12 sitting on a log just beside him. He had his hand inside his sack, rummaging for the food, when the boy let out a gasp, and he looked up, vision wavering in the firelight, to discover himself face to face with Claire's grandson, fair hair and a tousled halo round his head, and a look of horror on his face.
"Hush," he said in a whisper, and grabbed the child's knee in such a sudden grip that the boy gave a small yelp.
"Why, what's that you got there, Bert? Caught you a thief?"
Abe Shaftstall, distracted from a desultory game of knuckle bones, looked over his shoulder, peering short-sightedly at the boy. Christ, what was his name? His father was French. Was it Claude? Henri? No, that was the younger boy, the dwarf. "Tais-toi," he said under his breath to the boy, and turned to his companions.
No, this is a neighbour's son from Philadelphia. Bobby. Bobby Higgins," he added, grabbing at the first name that offered itself. "What's brought you out here, son?" he asked, hoping that the boy was as quick-witted as his grandmother.
"Looking for my granda,"
the boy replied promptly, though his eyes shifted uneasily round the circle of faces, now all aimed in his direction as the singing died away.
"My mam sent me with some clothes and food for him, but some wicked fellows in the wood pulled me off my mule and took everything."
The boy's voice trembled realistically, and Gray noticed that, in fact, his dirty cheeks showed the tracks of tears. This provoked a rumble of concern round the circle, and the immediate production from pokes and pockets of hard bread, apples, dried meat, and dirty handkerchiefs.
"What's your grandpa's name, son?" Joe Buckman inquired. "What company is he with?"
The boy looked nonplussed at this and shot a quick glance at Gray, who answered for him.
"James Fraser," he said,
with a reassuring nod that made his head throb.
"He'd be with one of the Pennsylvania companies, wouldn't he, Bobby?"
"Aye, sir."
The boy wiped his nose on the proffered handkerchief and gratefully accepted an apple. He interrupted himself with an artful coughing fit and amended this to,
"Thank you kindly, sir. And you, sir."
He handed back the handkerchief and set himself to ravenous consumption, this limiting his replies to nods and shakes of the head. Indistinct mumbles indicated that he had forgotten the number of his grandfather's company.
"No matter, boy," Reverend Woodsworth said comfortingly. "We're all a-going to the same place to muster. You'll find your grandpa with the troops there, surely. You think you can keep up with us, though, afoot?"
"Oh, aye, sir."
"Germaine, that was it," Germaine said, nodding fast.
"I can walk."
"I'll take care of him," Gray said hastily,
and that seemed to settle it. He waited impatiently until everyone had forgotten the boy's presence and begun to ready themselves for sleep, then rose, muscles protesting, and jerked his head at Germaine to follow him, muffling an exclamation of pain at the movement.
"Right," he said, in a low voice, as soon as they were out of earshot. "What the devil are you doing out here? And where is your bloody grandfather?"
"I was looking for him,"
Germaine replied, unbuttoning his flies to piss.
"He's gone to..."
He paused, obviously unsure what his relationship with Gray now was.
"Beg pardon, my lord, but I dinna ken should I tell you that or not. I mean..."
The boy was no more than a silhouette against the darker black of the undergrowth, but even the outline of his body expressed an eloquent wariness.
"Comment arrivez-vous être ici?"
"How did I come to be here?"
Gray repeated under his breath.
"Comment indeed?" "Never mind. I'll tell you where we're going, shall I? I gather we're bound for a place called Coriel's Ferry to join General Washington. Does that ring a bell?"
Germaine's slender shoulders relaxed, and a soft pattering on the earth indicated that apparently it did. Gray joined him, and finished, they turned back toward the glow of the campfire. Still in the shelter of the woods, Gray put his hand on Germaine's shoulder and squeezed. The boy stopped dead.
"Attendez, monsieur,"
Gray said, low-voiced. "If the militia learn who I am, they'll hang me. Instantly. My life is in your hands from this moment. Comprenez-vous?" There was silence for an unnerving moment.
"Are you a spy, my lord?"
Germaine asked softly, not turning round.
Grey paused before answering, wavering between expediency and honesty. He could hardly forget what he'd seen and heard, and when he made it back to his own lines, duty would compel him to pass on such information as he had.
"Not by choice," he said at last, just as softly.
A cool breeze had risen with the setting of the sun, and the forest murmured all around them.
"Bien,"
Germaine said at last,
"and thank you for the food."
He turned then, and Grey could see the glint of firelight on one fair brow, arched in inquisitiveness.
"So, I'm Bobby Higgins. Who are you then?"
"Bert Armstrong," Grey replied shortly. "Call me Bert."
He led the way then toward the fire, and the blanket humped rolls of sleeping men. He couldn't quite tell about the rustling of the trees and the snoring of his fellows, but he thought the little bugger was laughing. Chapter 52 Morphia Dreams. We slept that night in the public room of an ordinary in Langhorne. Bodies were sprawled on tables and benches, curled under tables, and laid in haphazard arrangements on pallets, folded cloaks, and saddlebags, as far away from the hearth as they could get. The fire was banked, but it still radiated considerable heat. The room was filled with the bitter scents of burning wood and boiling bodies. I estimated the temperature in the room at something like 95 degrees Fahrenheit, and the slumbering bodies on display were largely unclad, pale haunches, shoulders, and bosoms glimmering in the sullen glow of the embers. Jamie had been travelling in shirt and breeches, his new uniform and its dazzling small clothes carefully folded into a portmanteau until we got within range of the army, so his disrobing was a simple matter of unbuttoning his flies and pulling off his stockings. Mine was complicated by the fact that my travelling stays had leather laces, and over the course of a sweat-drenched day, the knot had tightened into a stubborn nodule that resisted all attempts.
"Are you no coming to bed, Sassenach?"
Jamie was already lying down, having found a remote corner behind the bar counter, and spread out our cloaks. "I've broken a fingernail trying to get this bloody thing loose, and I can't bloody reach it with my teeth," I said, on the verge of breaking into tears of frustration. I was swaying with weariness, but couldn't bring myself to sleep in the clammy confines of my stays. Jamie reached up an arm out of the darkness, beckoning.
"Come, lie down with me, Sassenach," he whispered. "I'll do it."
The simple relief of lying down after 12 hours in the saddle was so exquisite that I nearly changed my mind about sleeping in my stays. But he'd meant it. He squirmed down and bent his head to nuzzle at my laces, an arm round my back to steady me.
"Dinna fash,"
he murmured into my midsection, voice somewhat muffled.
"If I canna nibble it loose, I'll prize it wi' my dirk."
He looked up with an inquiring noise, as I'd uttered a strangled laugh at the prospect. "Just trying to decide whether being accidentally disemboweled would be worse than sleeping in my stays," I whispered, cupping his head. It was warm, the soft hair at his nape damp to the touch.
"My aim's no that bad, Sassenach,"
he said, pausing in his labours for an instant.
"I'd only risk stabbing you in the heart."
As it was, he accomplished his goal without recourse to weapons, gently jerking the knot loose with his teeth until he could finish the job with his fingers, opening the heavy-seamed canvas stays like a clamshell to expose the whiteness of my shift. I sighed like a grateful mollusk opening at high tide, plucking the fabric out of the creases the stays had made in my flesh. Jamie pushed away the discarded stays, but remained where he was, his face near my breasts, rubbing his hands gently over my sides. I sighed again at his touch. He'd done it by habit, but it was a habit I'd missed for the last 4 months, and a touch I'd thought never to feel again.
"You're too thin, Sassenach," he whispered. "I can feel every rib. I'll find you food tomorrow."
I had been too much preoccupied in the last few days to think about food, and was much too tired at the moment to be hungry, but made an agreeable sound in response, and stroked his hair, tracing the curve of his skull.
"I love you, Anian," he said, very softly, his breath warm on my skin.
"I love you," I answered just as softly, taking the ribbon from his hair and loosening his plait between my fingers. I pressed his head closer to me, not in invitation, but out of the sudden urgent need to keep him close to me, to protect him. He kissed my breast and turned his head, laying it in the hollow of my shoulder. He took one deep breath, one more, and then was asleep, the relaxing weight of his body against me, both protection and trust.
"I love you," I said, almost soundless, my arms wrapped tight about him. "Oh, dear God, I love you."
It might have been the sense of overwhelming fatigue, or the smell, the mingling of alcohol and unwashed bodies, that made me dream of the hospital. I was walking down the little hall beyond the men's ward at the hospital where I'd done my nurse's training, the tiny bottle of morphia grains in my hand. The walls were dingy grey, so was the air. At the end of the hall was the alcohol bath where the syringes were kept. I lifted one out, cold and slippery, careful not to drop it. But I did drop it. It slid from my hand and shattered on the floor, spraying glass shards that cut my legs. I couldn't worry about that. I had to get back with a morphine injection. Men were calling out behind me, desperate. And somehow, it was the sound of the operating tent in France back there. Men moaning, screams and hopeless sobbing. And my fingers shook with urgency, groping in the cold steel bath among glass syringes that rattled like bones. I pulled one out, gripping it so tightly that it too broke in my hand, and blood ran down my wrist. But I wasn't conscious of pain. Another. I must have another. They were in dreadful pain, and I could stop it, if only... Somehow I had a clean syringe and had got the top off the tiny bottle of morphia grains, but my hand was shaking, the grains spilling like salt. Sister Amos would be furious. I needed tweezers, forceps. I couldn't grasp the tiny pellets with my fingers, and in a panic shook several of them into the syringe, a whole grain, not the quarter grain called for, but I had to get to the men, had to stop their pain. Then I was running back down the endless grey hall toward the cries, shards of glass glinting among the red blood drops on the floor, both as bright as dragonfly wings. But my hand was growing numb, and the last syringe fell from my fingers before I reached the door. And I woke up with a jolt that seemed to stop my heart. I gulped smoke and the fug of beer and bodies, not knowing where I was.
"Jesus, Asenach, are you all right?"
Jamie, startled out of sleep, rolled up onto his elbow above me, and I came back into the present with as much of a jolt as my awakening had been. My left arm was numb from the shoulder down, and there were tears on my cheeks. I felt the coolness on my skin. A bad dream. I felt ashamed to confess it, as though it were his privilege alone to suffer nightmares.
"Ah."
He lowered himself beside me with a sigh, and gathered me to him with one arm. He ran a thumb over my face, and finding wetness, blotted it matter-of-factly with his shirt.
"All right now," he whispered,
and I nodded, thankful that I needn't talk about it.
"Good."
He stroked the hair off my face and rubbed my back gently, the circles of his hand growing gradually slower until he fell asleep again. It was deep night, and a deep sleep lay upon the room. The whole of it seemed to breathe in unison, snores and gasps and grunts all fading into something like the waves of a receding tide, rising and falling, and bearing me with them, safely back into the depths of sleep.
Only the pins and needles of feeling returning to my dead arm kept me from it, and that only momentarily. I could still see the blood and the shards of glass, and heard against the susurrus of snores the crash of falling crystal, saw the bloody smudges on the wallpaper at number 17. "Dear Lord," I prayed, listening to Jamie's heart under my ear, slow and steady, "whatever happens, let him have a chance to talk to William." Chapter 53. Taken at a Disadvantage. William led his horse down among the rocks to a level place where both of them could drink. It was mid-afternoon, and after a day spent riding to and fro along the column in the blazing sun, he was parched as a piece of last year's venison jerky. His present horse was Madras, a cob with a deep chest and a steady, stolid disposition. The horse waded purposefully into the stream, hock-deep, and sank his nose into the water with a blissful snort, shivering his coat against the cloud of flies that appeared instantly out of nowhere whenever they stopped. William waved a couple of insects away from his own face and took off his coat for a moment's relief from the heat. He was tempted to wade in, too, up to his neck, if the creek was deep enough, but... well... he looked cautiously over his shoulder, but he was well out of sight, though he could hear the sounds of the baggage train on the distant road. Why not? Just for a moment. It wasn't as though the dispatch he was carrying was urgent. He'd seen it written, and it contained nothing more than an invitation for General von Knyphausen to join General Clinton for supper at an inn with a reputation for good pork. Everyone was wringing with sweat. Dampness would be no telltale. He hastily shucked shoes, shirt, stockings, breeches and smalls, and walked naked into the purling water, which barely reached his waist, but was wet and cool. He closed his eyes in blissful relief, and opened them abruptly a half-second later. "William?" Madras flung up his head with a startled snort, showering William with droplets. But he barely noticed in the shock of seeing two young women standing on the opposite bank. "What the devil are you doing here?" He tried to squat a little lower in the water without being conspicuous about it, though a dim voice in the back of his mind wondered aloud why he bothered. Arabella Jane had already seen anything he had.
"And who's that?"
he demanded, jerking his chin at the other girl. Both of them were flushed as summer roses, but he thought, he hoped, it was the result of the heat.
"This is my sister, Frances," Jane said, with the elegance of a Philadelphia matron, and gestured to the younger girl. "Curtsy to his lordship now, Fanny."
Fanny, a very lovely young girl with dark curls peeping out under her cap, what was she, 11, 12? Bobbed him a sweet curtsy, blue and red calico petticoats outspread, and dropped long lashes modestly over the big, soft eyes of a young doe.
"Your most humble servant, mademoiselle," he said, bowing with as much grace as possible, which, judging from the expressions on the girls' faces, was probably a mistake.
Fanny clapped a hand over her mouth and went much redder from the effort not to laugh.
"I'm charmed to meet your sister," he said to Jane rather coldly, "but I fear you take me at something of a disadvantage, madam."
"Yes, that's a piece of luck," Jane agreed. "I couldn't think how we were to find you in that moil, and when we saw you ride past like the fiend was after you, we got a ride on a baggage wagon. I didn't think we'd ever catch you, but we took a chance and voila, fortuna favet audax, you know."
She wasn't even trying to pretend she wasn't laughing at him.
He scrabbled for some cutting rejoinder in Greek, but the only thing that came to his inflamed mind was a humiliating echo from his past, something his father had said to him on the occasion when he'd accidentally fallen into a privy.
"What news from the underworld, Persephone?"
"Turn your backs," he said curtly. "I'm getting out."
They didn't. Gritting his teeth, he turned his own back on them and deliberately climbed the bank,
feeling the itch of four interested eyes focused on his dripping backside. He grabbed his shirt and wrestled his way into it, feeling that even that much shelter would enable him to carry on the conversation in a more dignified manner. Or maybe he'd just tuck his breeches and boots under his arm and leave without further chat. The sound of heavy splashing, whilst he was still enveloped in the folds of his shirt, made him whirl round, head popping free just in time to see Madras lunge up out of the creek on the girl's side, lips already reaching for the apple Jane was holding out to him.
"Come back here, sir," he shouted.
But the girls had more apples, and the horse paid no attention whatever. Nor did he object when Arabella Jane took his reins and looped them casually around the trunk of a young willow. "I noticed that you didn't ask how we came to be here," she said. "Doubtless surprise has deprived you of your usual exquisite manners." She dimpled at him, and he eyed her severely.
"I did," he said. "I distinctly recall saying, 'What the devil are you doing here?'"
"Oh, so you did," she said without a blush. "Well, not to put too fine a point on the matter, Captain Harkness came back."
"Oh,"
he said, in a slightly different tone.
"I see. You, ran away then?"
Francis nodded solemnly. William cleared his throat.
"Why? Captain Harkness is doubtless with the army. Why would you come here, of all places, instead of staying safe in Philadelphia?"
"No, he isn't," Jane said. "He was detained on business in Philadelphia. So we came away. Besides," she added carelessly, "there are thousands of women with the army. He'd never find us, even if he was looking. And why should he be?"
That was reasonable.
Still, he knew what the life of an army whore was like. He also had a strong suspicion that the girls had run out on their contract with the brothel. Very few saved enough from their wages to buy their way out, and both of these girls were much too young to have made much money. To abandon the reasonable comfort of clean beds and regular meals in Philadelphia in order to accommodate filthy, sweating soldiers amidst mud and flies, paid in blows as often as in coin. Yet he was obliged to admit that he'd never been buggered by a vicious sod like Harkness, and thus had no true basis for comparison.
"I expect you want money to assist in your escape," he said, an edge in his voice.
"Well, perhaps," said Jane. Reaching into her pocket, she held up something shiny. "Mostly, I wanted to give this back to you."
His gorget.
He took an involuntary step toward her, toes squelching in the mud.
Thank you," he said abruptly.
He'd felt its lack every time he dressed, and felt even more the weight of his fellow officer's eyes on the empty spot where it should rest. He'd been obliged to explain to Colonel Desplaines what had happened, more or less, saying that he'd been robbed in a bawdy house. Desplaines had chewed him bloody, but then had given him reluctant leave to appear without a gorget until he might get another in New York.
What we really want is your protection," Jane said, doing her best to look winsomely earnest, and doing it damned well. "You what?"
"I don't think I should have any difficulty in making a living with the army," she said frankly, "but 'tisn't really what I want for my dear sister, that sort of life."
No, I imagine not," William said warily. "What else did you have in mind?"
"Lady's maid," he wanted to suggest sarcastically. But in light of the return of his gorget, he refrained. "I haven't quite made up my mind," she said, fastening her gaze on the ripples where the creek ran over rocks. "But if you could help us to get safely to New York, and maybe find us a place there..." William ran a hand down his face, wiping away a layer of fresh sweat.
"Don't want much, do you?" he said.
On the one hand, if he didn't give her some assurance of help, he wouldn't put it past her to fling his gorget into the water in a fit of pique.
And on the other, Frances was a lovely child, delicate and pale as a morning glory blossom. And on the third hand, he hadn't any more time to spare in argument.
"Get on the horse and come across," he said abruptly. "I'll find you a new place with the baggage train. I have to ride a dispatch to von Kniphausen just now, but I'll meet you in General Clinton's camp this evening. No, not this evening. I won't be back until tomorrow."
He fumbled for a moment, wondering where to tell her to find him. He could not have two young whores asking for him at General Clinton's headquarters.
"Go to the surgeon's tent at sundown tomorrow. I'll think of something."
Chapter 54, in which I meet a turnip. During the next day's ride, we encountered a messenger sent back from Washington's command with a note for Jamie. He read this leaning against a tree while I made an unobtrusive visit to a nearby clump of brush. "What does he say?" I asked, straightening my clothes as I emerged. I was still rather awed that Jamie had actually spoken with George Washington, and the fact that he was frowning at a letter presumably written by the future father of the country.
"Two or three things," he replied with a shrug,
and, refolding the note, stuffed it into his pocket.
"The only important bit of news is that my brigade is to be under the command of Charles Lee."
"Do you know Charles Lee?"
I got my foot into the stirrup and heaved myself into the saddle. "I know of him."
What he knew appeared to be rather problematic, judging from the line between his brows. I raised my own. He glanced at me and smiled.
"I met him, Ken, when I first met General Washington. I made it my business to learn a bit more about him since."
"Oh, so you didn't like him," I observed. And he gave me a small snort.
"No, I didn't," he said, nudging his horse into a walk. "He's loud and unmannerly and a sloven. I could see that much for myself. But from what I've heard since, he's also jealous to the bone and doesn't trouble to hide it very well."
"Jealous? Of whom?"
"Not Jamie, I hoped."
"Of Washington," he answered matter-of-factly, surprising me. "He thought he should have command of the Continental Army, and doesn't he like playing second fiddle?"
"Really?" I'd never once heard of General Charles Lee, which seemed odd, if he had such prominence as to have made that a reasonable expectation. "Why does he think that, do you know?"
"I do. He feels he has a good deal more in the way of military experience than Washington. And that's maybe true. He was in the British Army for some time and fought a number of successful campaigns. Still..."
He lifted one shoulder and dropped it, dismissing General Lee for the moment.
"I wouldn't have agreed to do this had it been Lee who asked me."
"I thought you didn't want to do it, regardless."
"Mm-hmm."
He considered for a moment.
"It's true I didn't want to do this. I don't know."
He looked at me apologetic.
"And I truly didn't want you to be here."
"I'm going to be where you are for the rest of our lives," I said firmly. "If that's a week, or another 40 years.
"Longer,"
he said, and smiled. We rode for a time in silence, but deeply aware of each other. We had been, since that conversation in the gardens at King Sessing.
"I will love you forever. It doesn't matter if you sleep with the whole English army." "Well, no, it would matter, but it wouldn't have stopped me loving you." "I've taken you to bed 1,000 times at least, Sassenach. Do you think I wasn't paying attention?" "There couldn't be anyone like you."